Welcome to our day four preview from the 2018 US Open. I'm Peter Rogers with Ravi Uber. A special welcome to tennis fans around the world listening in on Courtside, the official podcast of the US Open. So we've just run through day three. How about day four? What do you like most about the lineup there?
Well, we look at some of the matches that we do have the possibility for tomorrow. Roger Federer, obviously standing out. I mean, anytime he's on the schedule and the man that he's facing, Benoit Paire, you never really know what to expect from Benoit Paire, somebody who is such a talented player, but he can go off the rails. He has a wonderful two-handed backhand. That's going to be one to look forward to. I don't think we're going to get a lot of long points in that particular encounter between Federer and Paire. So that's one to look forward to for me. And then elsewhere, if we're still sticking to the men's side for a second, Gael Monfils and Kei Nishikori. Monfils, as much as we think of him, you know, playing at home, playing on the clay at the French Open where he's been to the semifinals, he's also been to the semifinals at the US Open. And in the past, he's often talked about how much he loves playing at this event. This is an early treat because he's facing a former US Open semifinalist in Kei Nishikori. We just talked about the injuries that Stan has had, that Milos Raonic has had. Nishikori, kind of the same thing as Raonic. There have been a lot of injuries in his career, which I think has prevented him from really hitting his potential, hitting his maximum. But we all know that he's a tremendous shot maker. Roger Federer once said that he's one of his favorite players to watch because of his ability to hit those brilliant shots. He once took out Andy Murray at the US Open. That was a real thriller. So that's going to be a great one. You have the offense and the attack of Nishikori, and I think the counterpunching of Monfils. Even though he can't play attacking tennis, I think his most preferred game is to hang back. And in this case, he's going to be soaking up the pace and infusing the aggression when he has the chance.
And on the women's side, are we likely to see an upset? I mean, there's so many question marks about a lot of the women's players right at the top end of the draw. When you look at it, Angelique Kerber, there's question marks around her. She's looked rusty since winning at Wimbledon. She takes on Johanna Larsson. We've got Petra Kvitova, who has those question marks over her performances in the slams over the last few years. She's taking on Wong. And then you've got Madison Keys, who's been a little up and down of late, taking on Bernardo Pera, who I know you like. But then arguably the focus mostly on Maria Sharapova, who, of course, returns to the big court in terms of the Arthur Ashe night session, second match on the night session against Sorana Kostia. But it was fascinating what happened to Sharapova. Although she won in that opening round win, wasn't all that convincing. Do you think she can turn it around and turn it on against the Romanian?
That's an interesting term you say there, Pete, turn it on. I'm not sure at this stage of her career, this stage of her comeback, that she does have the capability to turn it on. She didn't look great, let's be honest, against Patty Schnieder, a player who only hit her first winner at back end of the second set. Patty still moves very well. But I think there was an issue for Sharapova. You know, she wore that sweatband. We talked about it on the air, which is very unusual for her for us to see. So we speculated, was there an injury? And you know, when she took the wristband off, there was tape there. And then she said in the interview on court, you know, she didn't want to hit many backhands. So is there a problem with the wrist? Something was off with Sharapova. And I think that was pretty visible to see. So just based on that, the fact that, you know, perhaps she's not 100%, that Kristea does have an opportunity. Kristea is somebody who hits a bigger ball even than Sharapova. I think she's got so much pace on her ground strokes, Kristea. So I think that's going to be an interesting one based on what happened in Sharapova's first match, and she does not have many matches at all coming into the US Open.
With regards to the other players that I mentioned, yep, do you see any upsets happening?
Yeah, I think, I'm not necessarily sure if there would be an upset, but you mentioned Bernarda Pera. She's a player who started her tennis development a little bit later on. So she's, you know, going to be a bit of a late bloomer. But from what I've seen of her so far, she's a left-hander, hits a big ball. When she took on Madison Keys in Charleston on the clay, she should have, you know, probably won that match. She was up a break in the third set, and it was pretty clear, remembering that match, that once she had the break lead in the third set, I think it just kind of hit her, wow, I got a real chance to take out Madison Keys, and then the match turned. So I think having that experience will have helped, especially playing on what's going to be a big court against Madison Keys. That's going to be interesting. I mean, Keys has the experience. She has the bigger game. But I just think that there's a possibility that Pera could do something special.
so many questions to be answered. So just to run through the order of play for day four, start things off on the Arthur Ashe Stadium court. Of course, this starts an hour later than all the other courts, but it will be kicked off with Johanna Larsson taking on Angelique Kerber, who is now a three-time Grand Slam winner. Let's not forget that, the fourth seed in action there. Then that will be followed by Benoit Paire against Roger Federer. Federer not playing in the night session. He'll be out in the day against Paire, but on the Arthur Ashe court. And then it's Novak Djokovic's turn to enjoy the night and the slightly cooler temperatures. He takes on Tennis Sandgren, and then that'll be followed by that matchup we were just talking about, Maria Sharapova against Sarana Kastire. First matchup, meanwhile, on the Louis Armstrong Stadium court. Again, this one begins at 11 a.m. local time. Petra Kvitova looking to try and sort out her Grand Slam gremlins against Wang Yifan. And then that one will be followed by Nicola Mahut against one of my tips for perhaps the title, or at least maybe getting to the final. I do like Zverev this year, but let's see how he fares against the awkward customer in Mahut, who likes to come forward. Two contrasting styles there, but it is the fourth seed Zverev, who is the second matchup on the Louis Armstrong court. And then we have Madison Keys against Bernarda Pera. Of course, Keys, a former finalist here. That's an all-American tie. And then into the night session on Louis Armstrong, it will be Gael Monfils against Kei Nishikori. A popcorn encounter that you were just talking about. That will be followed by Lucia Tsarenko against the second seed, Caroline Wozniacki, who made light work of her first round matchup. She'll be hoping to do just the same against Lucia Tsarenko.
Good player is Tsarenko. And Wozniacki retired in Cincinnati.
And we've certainly seen some talented Ukrainians today. But that's all for tomorrow. And that's our preview of day four of the 2018 US Open. For Ravi Uber, I'm Pete Hodges. Thanks for listening. Join us for complete live coverage every day on US Open Radio, presented by American Express. You can find us on usopen.org or the US Open app.
This year at the U.S. Open on Courtside, the official podcast, we're interviewing some of the personalities behind the tennis and beyond the court. And one of those today includes a player, actually a U.S. Open champion, Nick McCarville here. And I'm sitting alongside Horia Takau, who is our defending doubles champion, alongside Jean-Julien Roger. And Horia has a book that he released a couple years ago in Romanian, and just this year he's released the book in English as well. It's called Life is Like a Tennis Game. And I guess first for you, Horia, I mean, first off, congratulations, and just talk about how this project came to be, and then also, obviously, you released it in Romanian, that was a couple years ago, but the decision to also release it in English.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm really excited about this. It all came about at the end of 2015, which for me was my best year of my career. The year I won Wimbledon, and we won the World Tour Finals, ATP World Tour Finals, and we finished the year number one as a team together with Jean-Julien Roger. So at the end of that year, there was a lot of media attention on me in Romania, a lot of people interviewing, but also through my friends, that a lot of them are coaching young kids. During one of my Kids Day event that I host every year at the end of the year in Romania, I was playing around with kids, and I remember how I was their age, and everybody, all of those kids, they had questions, you know, like, oh, you're a champion now, but how did you do it? How did you do it when you had to deal with tennis and splitting between tennis and school? How did you do it when you were losing and your parents were pissed at you? Or, you know, these are honest questions that kids were asking me. And I was sitting with my friends that were coaching these kids, and I was like, this information needs to be shared with these kids, you know, because I feel like I experienced a lot, and I have a lot of stories to share, and would be nice to put it all together in a book, or in an interview, I was thinking. At that point, it was still a thought. And a week later, the publishing company, they got in touch with me, and they were asking if I want to be part of a book together with one big soccer player in Romania and one big handball player. These are the three top sports in Romania. So it didn't work out with the other two. I was the only one that said yes right away, and that's when we started this project.
Yeah.
And it took a while, because in the same time I was training, playing tournaments, and mining my career. So it took from March to, I think, the end of October to finalize everything, and then put it in paper and release it in December 2016.
So then talk us through it. The book is sitting in front of us. I'll tweet out a picture of it because it's so cool. The illustrations in it are awesome pictures from your life. But can you just talk about, you mentioned it a little bit, trying to connect with those kids who have so many questions. But what's the premise overall of the book itself?
Yeah, well, I have it right here on the cover. There's one little guy that holds a tennis racket, and he's dreaming to become this huge champion, you know, that. But he needs to grow. Like, he needs to get the support, the healthy support, and so he can grow into this champion. So a lot of these lessons that I wrote down in this book are some of the key lessons that I've learned through the years, together with my family, with my coaches, with my friends, with my doubles partners. Some of them I had to go through a few times before I learned them, and they helped me become a better man, a better tennis player, better partner for my doubles partner. So I put all these stories into this book, and I also have some interactive games for the kids that are going to read this book, because they need to start writing their own story just like I did. And what I didn't mention is when I was a kid playing tennis, I used to write a lot, write all my experiences. I was going to play tennis tournaments when I was 12, 14, and writing scores down and how I felt at 14. And I had a record of all these books and going through them. You know, there was, I felt very emotional going through them, and also that I can use them now for the purpose of this book, because I know a lot of these kids have questions and you know, dilemmas, how they should be, how they should act, what they should talk about, how they should react in some situation. And a lot of them, I just put them straight up in this book, how I dealt with them and how they helped me. And if those experiences would help the kids that are trying to play tennis or other sports even, or the parents that are they have their kids playing tennis and they want to know what's going through a kid tennis player's mind, when because some kids, they have difficulties to share these experiences, how they're dealing with it, and some parents don't spend enough time to listen to their kids, how they feel about it. So I feel it's valuable not only for the kids but also for the parents and the coaches and teachers around them. And I just feel like it would help everyone understand it better, this going through life, you know, by playing a sport through tennis and learning a lot.
Well, you've learned a lot, obviously, from your career. You've won 35 career titles. You mentioned Wimbledon. I mentioned the U.S. Open piece of it. And I haven't gotten the chance to read it, but skimming through it, it looks like, too, that you're not only trying to connect with kids who are trying to reach the high level of athletics, whether it be you started in swimming or tennis or whatever sport they choose, but also, as you're saying, you're trying to connect just with kids that might use athletics as an outlet, or they might try to be serious of it, but it's accessible in that way too.
Yes, it's not only for the kids that play tennis. It's about sports, and it's about life and experiences and dealing with challenges and learning how to view these challenges, how to react on them, and how to improve to get better. And I hope everybody gets some lessons from it, and it's useful.
I wanted to ask you, last year you won the ATP's Arthur Ashe Humanitarian Award for 2017. You've done a lot of work outside of tennis. You've written this book, which I think you're obviously very proud of, but you're 33 now. Obviously, your career is still going well, but it seems as though you've taken a viewpoint away from just tennis and trying to impact the world in a different way, too.
Yeah, I've been working closely with UNICEF Romania and other foundations that have work in Romania, work on helping kids through the right education. And I feel, I mean, it's not only in Romania, this is worldwide, but I'm from Romania and I see it happening there, where children with a lot of potential and healthy and happy, you know, they just need the right support and the right education around them to excel at what they want to do in life. And a lot of times, because they don't have that support, their life just turn into a not so happy directions. But they're all kids, they're all the same, they're all happy, they're all playing, they're all they need is the support. So just by seeing this around me, I couldn't ignore it, you know, like I got involved and I started helping, and by helping I started also feeling a purpose for myself, you know. This is not just me running around chasing titles and for my ego and for my, you know, career, you know. Sure. I feel like with every experience that I go through and I learn more this year at the US Open, last year at the US Open or other tournaments, I learn things that I can share. You know, I can share in interviews, I can share in books like this, I can share when I go and speak to these children. And that's the core of it, the core of these actions. And ATP was very nice and kind, and they awarded me the humanitarian award last year. And together we had a big amount of money going to the foundation that helps me make those visits in Romania, and we're donating a lot of books in schools, you know. Yeah. you go through some families that don't own a book in their house, you know, so we're going in and we give them books, and the kids start reading, and they start enjoy reading, and then they ask for more books, and it's all a process, it's a long-term process, but you need to give them the right tools. And by going through this process, I learned for myself that in order for me to go in and help more, I need to be more also as a person, to be able to give more to those kids. And so I needed to get better at what I need to do, you know, what I need to work on. So that kind of gave me also something to work on, because if I want to go out and be involved and help these kids, then I need to learn it first and learn it well before I go and talk to them. So that also made some like speed up the process of me learning it, and it's something that I have to use in my life every day. And you know, like the discipline, the hard work, believing in my partner and my coaches, and working together as a team, and enjoying the process, enjoying everything around us, you know. That's something that we do every day, and I need to get very good at that in order for me to go and talk to these kids. So that was also a big help for me.
It sounds like you've learned a lot through the process. What was the coolest part, or what was one aspect of it that you enjoyed the most of becoming an author?
There's a lot. Meeting the kids, yeah. That's the highlight of this whole process. Every time I go in schools or in tennis clubs and I meet the kids and I donate the book, and they're just happy kids playing a sport or just studying. And I remember how I was when I was a kid. If I had the opportunity to, you know, speak to somebody that was doing something well and ask them questions, so that part I enjoy very much. You know, being around the kids and offer them knowledge, encouragement, and also getting a lot of energy from them. You know, that gives me a lot of purpose, but also I feel for me that those are the first few steps in what I would like to do in the future, you know, like being involved also in education, working with kids in Romania or worldwide. So I feel like these are the first my first lessons now. I'm learning about it, yeah. And I feel like it's heading to a path where I enjoy it very much. So I'm riding this wave right
awesome.
Now.
And you've also got a U.S. Open title to defend in doubles, right?
Yes. In the meantime, yes, it's a different situation than last year. Last year we're fit and training, and we came here, and this year I'm coming off of a 3-month injury, so I've only been playing for the last 3 weeks, which have been a great weeks in terms of winning matches, and we were able to win last week in Winston-Salem, and we're coming in with a lot of confidence to New York. We won our match today, so that's a big step, but we're competitive and we would like to win it. But first of all, for me, I need to take care of my body, keep an eye on my foot to behave well and to recover well each day. We're taking one match at a time and just enjoying, making the best of it.
Okay, and lastly, before I let you go, how do people find your book if they want to check it out?
Well, in Romania, it's in stores. We launched it there, and now in English, we just released, I think it was a number of 1,000 copies in English, and I just wanted it to donate it at this year's U.S. Open, and I wanted the kids and the coaches and the parents and everybody that feels like they wanna get it and read it, the ones that were here and were able to get it, I would just like the feedback and to see if it's something they would recommend it to other people, other kids, clubs, tennis players, parents, because if they do, then I'm thinking to launch it internationally, you know, and put it on I don't know, a platform to be sold and shipped worldwide.
Awesome. Well, he's a U.S. Open champion and also now an author. Horia Takau, thanks for chatting with us.
Thank you.
You can find us on Courtside all over the internet. Download us on Audio Boom, and we've got more great coverage throughout this U.S. Open.
Celebrating 50 years of the U.S. Open with Monica Seles. How do you feel, I mean, about the anniversary, thinking about it now? You know, the tournament is having a 50th anniversary, and it's become such an enormously significant event in the world of sports and the city of New York, all of American sports. How do you feel about that?
Well, I always love playing in New York at the Open. I mean, in the New York crowds are nowhere else to be seen, heard, that excitement, that energy. I mean, the U.S. Open was ahead of its time with the equal prize money for both men and women. So for me as a former female player, that was a huge step forward for them. And personally, I just always love playing in the city. I mean, once Mayor Dinkins made that decision that no planes can fly over, it was definitely a lot better, more comfortable for us players, but under all circumstances, I love playing there. Some of my favorite matches are from the Open, like when I played Jennifer Capriati.
Yep, we're going to get to that.
So, anyway, so I just have some wonderful memories, really.
So, Monica, you kind of got your bearings at the Open, but it was really in '91 that you. That was the breakthrough year for you in New York. By then, you'd already won a couple of times in Roland Garros, and you had made your mark at the majors. Talk about, you alluded to it earlier, but let's start with the epic against Jennifer in the semifinals. Yeah. A 15-year-old against a 17-year-old, and it goes down to a final set tiebreaker, and Jennifer serves for the match a couple of times. She's 2 points away from winning. She's just spilling her guts on the court, as were you. And it was one of the great women's matches I've ever seen at the U.S. Open. Talk about it now, looking back on it so many years later, why you were able to pull that match out in the end.
I think definitely. I mean, for sure, I would say if you would ask me personally, Jennifer is probably one of those players that could just the matches she and I play kind of get the both the best out of each other. I mean, some I won, some she won, and that one really, in you know, looking back, it was based on one or two points either one of us could have won it. It was a coin toss essentially. I mean, I just remember coming into the match, we played some amazing matches in San Diego where I think Jennifer beat me in a tough three-setter. So coming into it, we just had all this drama built up and things like that. And we're both so young at that stage. I mean, gosh, looking back as, you know, an older person now, I cannot believe how both of us handled the pressure of that match, the expectations, and really the level that we played. I think that was the first time that two kids, essentially, or two teenagers, two tennis players, how you want to phrase
it,
just hit the ball hard of both sides, really, because we pounded that ball so hard back to back, and every point required 100% of our focus. We could, because we knew one or two points could decide the match, so there was no let up going on there. The intensity was so high. The crowds definitely and totally understandably were for Jennifer. I mean, she was from New York, so that made it even, you know, more, the electricity was more exciting. And I'm not sure for me, besides my family, anybody else was rooting for me, but looking back.
But there was a lot of respect for Monica. I think that crowd really respected you, your grit and your determination. And in some ways, I thought that although they were cheering more loudly for Jennifer, that there was a silent minority on your side.
Yes, I would say that's nicely put. But I think we kind of set the bar for the younger generation who watched that match, who says, hey, if we want to beat Jennifer and Monica, this is the level of tennis we got to play. And for me personally, kind of now when I look back at my career, it's probably one of my all-time favorite matches. Where both physically and mentally, every ball, that intensity was just really to the extreme. And I mean, I can't speak for Jennifer, but in my case, I was definitely so exhausted, and I still don't know how the next day,
well,
you know,
yes.
I had to come back.
Yeah, exactly. You had to come back, and not just against anybody. You had to play Martina Navratilova in the final. Totally different kind of match. Serve and volleyer, another left-hander. How did you make that adjustment emotionally and technically to turn it around after the epic semi with Jennifer and find a way to defeat Martina?
Well, I think it helped that, you know, I was 17 for sure, and your body really just had that extreme ability to recover that is, you know, as you get older, much harder and harder, although some of the current players like Roger and Serena and Nadal are defying that age, which in my generation was very different. For me, I think it was just youth, and I think the energy of being in my first U.S. Open finals, I just never believed I could really win the Open in Wimbledon. Those were the two tournaments. I was like, okay, French, Australian Open have better chances. So when I got to my first finals of the Open, I was like, okay, I gotta take this. And I went from playing a younger person in Jennifer, and then playing really probably, I think she was probably one of the oldest finalists at that stage of the Open, Martina. So, you know, it was a lot of extremes. And as you mentioned, the style of play was very extreme, had to make very quick adjustments. But as Martina,
how did you make especially on the returns, right? How did you deal with that, you know, with her coming in and pressuring you that way? And you didn't usually have to think about returning in that fashion against a serve volleyer.
No, I think with Martina, what really helped me that I always liked targets. So I kind of just said, you know, with Jen, every point was long. It was at least 10 plus point rally. Is with Martina, I knew it would be a lot shorter. So I just said, I have to go for my shots. It will be a match where or I'm going to win it by going for it, or I'm going to lose it. The margins will be very slim. And that was really the case. I mean, essentially in both matches, the margins were very slim. But thankfully, you know, for me, they went my way. But, you know, it's one of those things that really, you know, truthfully could go either way, both matches.
So the key to that final was it went to a first set tiebreak with Martina, and then you won that 7-1, and then you seemed to really, that seemed to relax you, and you were hitting a lot of winners in the second set, a lot of spectacular returns. Did you feel very confident coming out of the tiebreak and feel in a way that you were destined to win at that stage?
Well, I think as I remember a little bit, Martina, just that when I had that one break, she kind of just lost a little bit of that self-confidence in her, a bit, just that wind. And I think that gave me huge, you know, confidence. Hey, I won the first set. I'm up for break. You just kind of, as a player, you sense it when that tide shifts. And I could feel that tide shift at that moment.
So what was the feeling like as you closed in on the title and eventually captured it? You'd known what that was like at other majors, and you'd had great success already in Roland Garros, as you would in Australia. What did it mean to you to win that U.S. Open for the first time?
Was it like 27 years ago or how many? No. I think, you know, there's no feeling like when you win your first Grand Slam of a type. And for me, that was my first U.S. Open. So that feeling was just pure joy. I think also pure relief that, hey, I'm not just one type of a court player, that it wasn't just clay I could play. I could play now on hard courts too. And to be two players who are so different in their playing styles, to me, it just gave me confidence. And 91 was like a huge breakthrough year, being number one in the world, winning the two Grand Slams, kind of, you know, all these expectations through my junior career. And it's kind of like, I don't know, to say just something, you kind of inwardly, you know, okay, I'm doing pretty good here. I can just take a little bit of a deeper breath. But unfortunately, as we all know in tennis, you're only as good as your last result. So very fast, I think after the Open, I had to go to Tokyo to play. So you really can't relax too much. But it's still an amazing feeling to know that, hey, I'm a U.S. Open, a French Open champion, and that stays forever, even probably as a 17-year-old.
So, Monica, after that 92 Open, you didn't play again at the Open again until 95, and you suffered an unthinkable tragedy in April of 93 in Germany. But now you come back after nearly 28 months away, a very courageous comeback. You won easily in Canada, the tournament leading up to the U.S. Open, and then made the final. And that, to me, was one of the most impressive performances you ever gave in defeat. And you were somewhat unlucky to lose to Steffi Graf in that U.S. Open final. What are your memories of that contest? Because mine is that you had a tiebreaker, a set point in the tiebreak, thought you'd served an ace in that first set tiebreak, and it was called just wide. And that turned it, because Steffi came back, won the tiebreak, and eventually beat you in three sets.
Yeah, that was an amazing match. I mean, for both the whole, you know, my time away and all that stuff. I wish we had Hawkeye then, just kidding. No, but I think into the Open, not playing for so long and just playing one tournament before in Toronto, where I really just played, you know, out of my mind. Even for me, I did not expect to win it, my first tournament back. I remember coming into New York and just the way the city embraced me, going into restaurants and just people giving me standing ovation. It was kind of like, oh my gosh, I'm just playing tennis. You know, let me just stay focused and things like that. But when I did get to the finals to play against Steffi, I mean, it was just one of the expectations were so high. That was the match that everybody wanted to see. And unfortunately, this time I came out on the losing end of it in a very tough match. And then when after the match, the clouds opened up, I was like, oh, relief. I think probably she would say the same thing if you asked her, because I'm sure there's a lot of pressure for her too coming into that match. And I just knew I made the right decision in my own mind about coming back to tennis at whatever level, wherever tennis and life is going to take me. But I returned to something that I love to do. Obviously, I would have loved to have won the Open. What a fairy tale that would have been, but it wasn't meant to be. And I was just happy to return to that stage at that level.
Well, Monica, thanks a lot for joining me. A final tack on was the Jennifer match. Is that the moment above all others for you at the U.S. Open, the pulling out that great semifinal, or is there something else that stands out?
No, I would have to say that match, because I think both both Jennifer and me. Jennifer's, I think, 14 or 15. I'm 17. We're both so young. And to play at that level with that maturity, the expectations, the pressures on us, I mean, very few people can relate to that. And the fight we put up for every point, that intensity, that maturity that we both had, I think we haven't really seen at that age since. And I'm not sure we'll see it anytime soon. So for me, it's always very, very special memories. I mean, when I came on the tour, all the players were a lot older, and it was just great to have somebody like Jennifer who, you know, you could relate to. And I hope she felt the same way, because, you know, we were kind of just navigating our own waters. There's nobody that we could call, hey, how do you do this when you're 14, 15? And most of our friends were, you know, back in school, and we were getting education on the tour. So it's a very different life, but it was a, you know, I love playing tennis. So I'm very thankful.
Well, Monica, we were thankful for the spirit that you brought to the game and the spunk and all of the originality. As you said, as a left-hander, two-fisted up both sides, we'll never forget watching you play in your prime. I know I won't. So thanks so much for joining me today, Monica.
Thank you, Steve. Much appreciated, and see you soon.
All right. Okay. Absolutely. You got it. Thanks for listening to Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. We hope you enjoy the 2018 U.S. Open, and thank you for listening all year to our celebration of 50 years of the U.S. Open.